Now, Collins made a matching stinger for the 8-4. Do you happen to know the model number?
Oh, boy. Offhand, no, I don't remember which one. What the number was. Oh, boy. I can picture it and all, but offhand, I don't remember. I haven't looked at it, you know, quite a while. I don't remember who even had that speaker for sale there. I don't know what he wanted for it. He was sitting on top of the 8-4. He was trying to sell the 8-4. I believe he wanted to sell both pieces, I'm sure, the 8-4 and the speaker. You know, he was sitting right next to Andy, Rich. To tell you the truth, maybe Andy would even know who that person was. Over.
KCJJ. Did she? Okay, we got both Doug and another person. Doug first, go ahead.
Now, the original speaker for the A4 is called a 312A1, 312A-1. It's a 10-inch, 10-inch speaker, and it has the fluorescent bulb on top of it, the Lumaline lamp.
Oh, thank you very much.
Wow. Hey, who is the other person who signed in?
WB2CQT.
WB2CQT. Start over your name, sir, and your question or comment.
Okay, the name is Larry, and the question I have actually is about 60 Minutes this evening. If anybody saw that, I missed the very first part where they described this device for repelling people. I'd like to know if anybody knows the principle of operation, whether it's a sound wave or a microwave, or if anybody saw that, they know how it operates. I'm the one that had the receiver at the flea market, and he could get the speaker and a nice meter all for $800.
Very fine, Larry. So you're the person with the table very close to Andy's tune-up clinic table. I'm familiar with that, I don't know what they call it now, repelling ray machine. There's been write-ups on it for about a year and a half, 2 years at least, on various websites. It is an extremely high power, 90 gigahertz transmitter. That flat plate that you see on top of the tracked vehicle is a phased array, and that phased array does put out a pretty strong amount of signal for a fraction of a mile. It gives you heating for a very short distance, like a 1/16 of an inch or a 1/32 of an inch. Below the skin level is where it creates the heating. And so the pure flux density, watts per square meter, is what that thing does. The heating effect with the pulsating of the heating, the way they set it up, particularly if they set the pulsing at the alpha rhythm rate of the human brain, it is a very repelling thing. Scares the daylights out of people. And if you want to break up a crowd, the majority of the crowd exposed to that thing will know that something is wrong and flee and go in some other direction. Though I didn't actually see the 60 Minutes, but it was described to me tonight by my wife. She did see it and told me that the military had decided not to go. Let me drop. Not to go with that approach. They really wanted a more lethal weapon. And I am guessing there's two or three reasons why. Number one, that thing is, in my opinion, not eye safe, particularly if you're not wearing glasses. The 90 gigahertz energy hitting the cornea of your eye could, in some circumstances, do eye damage. The eye is the most vulnerable portion of the human body when it comes to radio frequency biohazard. Second of all, although it is a strongly repelling device, it is not thoroughly decisive, in my opinion. A trained group of people could put their hand over their eyes and keep right on running and shooting toward the target, if you know what I mean. Whereas a lethal weapon will stop you in your tracks. So it's an extremely expensive technique. It is controversial as far as its long-range safety is concerned, particularly for the operators. There is a question about an operator of that machine, even if he's wearing the right kind of a protective suit. is he really safe? But because of its expense and because it is not a complete stopper in the track, I think that's the reason why, for the most part, it wasn't chosen. I wonder if anyone else saw the presentation, has any further information for Larry. Sign in right now and give us your information. K2LIW on the TechNet.
KTO.
Who is that again?
Kilo 2 Yankee Oscar, this is Bernie. I was just going to comment on Matt Drudge's site, the Drudge Report. There was some video of the reporter kind of playing around with the system and trying various methods to resist it. I saw this 2 or 3 days ago, so I believe it's probably still up there.
Very fine, Bernie. Why don't you give us a few words on what you remember after reading that Drudge Report? What did they say? And take your time. You got it, Bernie.
They didn't go into too much how it worked. It was just the tagline of it was kind of a gag of, hey, reporter gets shot by military. But the reporter was basically recording, it was probably stuff, they may have used some of it in the 60 Minutes piece, I did not see it. But he was probably, I'm going to guess, 100 yards downrange from the machine. It showed the operator who basically had some type of optical targeting system where he would point he had a square that he basically put on what he wanted to impact with this thing. And the reporter tried the various things. He tried how long he could stand it. The answer was about 3 seconds, and then he had to bail off. It was kind of a free exchange thing. The military was obviously working with him and helping him. I almost kind of got the impression the military wanted people to see that this is out there, and kind of, you know, that they were definitely supportive of the process. And he tried, the reporter, tried a piece of plywood probably, it was about the width of himself, but maybe 3 to 4 feet tall. And he tried holding that in front of him, and he said the problem actually was that his shins and feet were exposed, and they were feeling the sensation. So then he tried a mattress, and he was able to make some progress with the mattress, but as he got closer, I believe as you said, Dick, it just got more and more intense. But it was rather interesting to see and to kind of realize the impacts of these kind of things, as they could maybe be weaponized.
Interesting. Yeah, mattress to me at 90 gigahertz has partial transparency. A good thick piece of plywood is not really transparent. From the photographs that I've seen, the size of that array in the 90 gigahertz, which is millimeter wave frequencies, you're going to have an extremely sharp beam width with that thing, almost like a water cannon, if you know what I mean. Just a little bit wider than that, but not much. So you could very precisely aim it over a fraction of a mile. In order for us to do a Google search or any other kind of a search, a Drudge search, what words did they use to describe the piece of hardware? What did they call it? I'm pretty sure they did not call it a heating machine, a ray gun. Well, what did they call it, if you happen to remember, Bernie? K2YO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Unfortunately, I'm going to fail you there. I would recommend go to the Drudge Report is just a page full of links to other news media. So go to Drudge, D-R-U-D-G-E, for the word report, traditional spelling, .com. And it was, when I saw it, it was on the left-hand column. It has 3 columns of links. It was on the left-hand column about halfway down. With it being on 60 Minutes, I'm pretty sure it's probably going to be on YouTube. Once again, I'm sorry, I don't know what to search for. But I would suspect maybe if you went to the 60 Minutes website, they may also have some of that video.
Yeah, that's a good way to get specific words, by going to a CBS television 60 Minutes program, and I'm pretty sure we can download that report. Fun stuff. RF Energy, I know, has a lot of application when it comes to hypothermia for cancer research. I'm sure that the RF can do a lot of good news along those lines. When it comes to diathermy, in the past, RF has done some good things. Microwave ovens, we all use them. You guys may get a kick out of this. I was at a meeting that shall remain nameless as to what meeting it was, but it was a meeting of rather high technology, very well educated people, I guess there were 30 people in the room, and someone found out that I work with RF and work with antennas and so on, and a man who was a computer scientist, engineering scientist, computer scientist type person, walked up to me and said, "Hey, Dick, when I take my food out of the microwave oven, how long should I let it RF-wise cool off? What's the half-life so that the microwave won't be dangerous to me when I eat the food? How long does it take for the food to cool down RF-wise?" And to a person who doesn't know very much about how a microwave oven works, maybe that's a logical question for such an educated person to ask a question like that. I was a little bit amazed. And the answer is a nanosecond. In other words, as soon as the B-plus leaves the magnetron tube that's in your microwave oven, and as soon as the timer dings, it turns off, that food is already RF-wise cold, even before you get a chance to open the door, because the way the microwave oven works is that the RF energy is bouncing back and forth inside of that closed cavity. There's nothing in there that's lossy except your food, and namely the water that's in your food is what's doing all the absorbing. The 2450 megacycles that the microwave oven operates at, there's absolutely nothing magic about that frequency. You'd be amazed how many people think that that's the frequency that water and water vapor will absorb RF energy. The first water vapor absorption line occurs at 22 gigahertz, not 2.45 gigahertz. That frequency was chosen because it's high enough for the wave to fit into a convenient-sized oven, and that particular set of frequencies was left over as an unlicensed frequency band at the time, and so it was chosen. There's nothing magic about that frequency. You could make a microwave oven work at 900 megs, 2 gigs, 5 gigs, 10 gigs, whatever. You'd just be changing the brand name of the magnetron tube, so to speak, and maybe the rate at which you turn the turntable in order to evenly heat your food. Microwave ovens are fun things. The most fun experiment you can do with a microwave oven, and after you do it, you can ask your friends, how in the world does it do this? And it all happened, you may have heard the story before, of where someone told me that if you do such and such, your chances of being happy are about as good as a snowball in a microwave oven. Well, that happened to be a February day. I go outside and I get a handful of snow, made it into a snowball, put it into my microwave oven alongside of a glass of water. Run the microwave oven, 750 watts, full blast, for 1 minute. And you ask the average person what will happen, and they're positive the snowball will melt. Absolutely nothing happened to the snowball, and the glass of water got hot. And then I said, well, snow is mostly air. Maybe that's why it didn't happen. The next thing I did was to put an ice cube into the microwave oven alongside of another glass of water. Ran it full blast, 750 watts for a minute, and the water again got hot, not quite ready to boil, and the ice cube had a little bit of frost on the surface because of the vapor that was coming off the glass of water. The bottom line is that ice, which is crystalline form of water, is an extremely different substance. It doesn't have anywhere near the loss characteristics at radio frequency that water does. Water has a dielectric constant of 81 and an extreme loss to RF energy. It's a very good dummy load. So it's the water in your food that does all of the cooking. But ice is a material that will not absorb RF energy per se, ice and snow. As I said, it's a crystalline form of water. It's got a very different dielectric constant. It's got the exact same mass, almost the exact same volume, but it's an entirely different substance. It takes a while to figure out what's going on there. And it's now you know why your microwave oven has a so-called defrost cycle for frozen food. Let me drop again. And the reason for that is because you want to very slowly heat the food. Some portion of the food will absorb some of the RF energy. And you want that portion to slowly spread its heat over into the other frozen portions. If you ran your microwave oven full blast with a frozen chunk of food, you'd have a rubbery, ugly tasting mess where certain portions of it would be overheated, those are the portions that melted first. The portions that were frozen would get no heat at all. They'd be thoroughly raw. So it'd be a blotchy chunk of meat with sections that are overcooked and sections that are thoroughly raw. That's what would happen if you didn't use the defrost cycle. So a microwave oven on frozen food requires a delicate approach in order to make it work properly. Anyone have any further questions or comments on that? Give me a call that is right now, K2LIW on the TechNet. Okay, Mel, have you had any interesting emails this week? And over to you, K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm just getting them out. This is K2KEY, a little late today with everything. Yeah, very interesting. You know, it was an article. I don't know if I ever brought this up before. But they said that in the article that, you know, a lot of people are worried that their teacups or coffee mugs may have a high lead content. And they said if you take a cup of water and you put it into one of those cups, and it seems like it takes quite forever for the water to get hot or boil in the cup much more than in a normal, you know, another cup or that they use one of those paper cups or whatever, that a way of determining it will determine to some extent the lead content of the porcelain or the ceramic cup. Did you ever hear of anything of that such thick? Does it sound plausible? Over.
I've never heard that, and if I did hear it, I almost would not believe it. Let me show you why. There's many a person who picks up a piece of Tupperware and wants to know, is it appropriate for a microwave oven? They make the mistake of taking the Tupperware, put it in the microwave oven, close the door, and turn it on to see if it gets hot. That, believe it or not, is an invalid test, which will most of the time give you a false positive. By that I mean, if you recognize the way a microwave oven works, is that the RF energy squirted into the oven by way of the little probe coming from the magnetron tube that's oscillating at 2450 megacycles, the microwave energy bounces back and forth in that oven because it's a thoroughly shielded chamber, thoroughly lossless chamber, and the only thing that has lost is the material you put in there. If I put in a piece of hamburger, for instance, that's unfrozen, the water in the hamburger absorbs the RF energy, and the hamburger cooks somewhat from the inside out. It doesn't quite go all the way to the center. You got a depth of penetration of the microwave, but still, it cooks a lot deeper than an ordinary convection oven would. If I put a nearly lossless material in there, like rather good Tupperware, but it's not quite as good as Teflon, but it's good Tupperware, the chunk of meat would absorb the microwave by the microwave bouncing back and forth twice before the hamburger finally absorbed it. The Tupperware, which is a much lower loss material, the microwaves would bounce 30 times instead of 2 times, but still be absorbed. Therefore, the Tupperware will get hot, even though it's reasonably good. If you put a standard load in the microwave oven, like a glass of water, and now you put your Tupperware in there, the glass of water and a hamburger, for instance, side by side, would be essentially equally heated. A glass of water and Tupperware that's microwave rated, the Tupperware would run cold. Because of the glass of water, the microwaves only get a chance to bounce twice before getting absorbed. So without a standard load, there's two things wrong when you're testing an unknown substance. Number one, if the substance was real good, the microwave oven will think it's empty and you might damage the magnetron tube. You should never run a microwave oven empty. When in doubt, put at least a cup of water in there. Now, when you put in this cup of water that you think has got lead in it, and you think the lead is acting as a shield, even if the lead is acting as a partial shield, that just means that the microwaves have to bounce more times before they're fully absorbed, but they're still going to be absorbed. So even if the cup is partially leaded and partially shielded, the rate at which the microwaves are heating your water would be almost the same, because the only other thing in that environment that can absorb is the magnetron tube itself could reabsorb some of the energy that... The magnetron tube itself is a little bit of a load for the oven. It's issuing the signal, and it can absorb a little bit of signal. That's the mechanism by which it could become damaged if the oven was thoroughly empty. So, in my opinion, Mel, it's not a good test. if you've got any kind of cookery, any kind of cutlery, I guess I'm looking for, any kind of cups, glass, saucers, and whatever, plates, that you think contain lead, you've got to be very careful with them. You may or may not know that for a 300-year period of time, maybe even a longer period of time, tomatoes were considered a poisonous food. The reason for that is many of the utensils people drank out of and ate off of in those days had a high lead content or were made out of lead themselves. The acid in tomato would eat into the lead, bring it into solution, and then you ate the tomato and the food that contained tomato, and you're eating a high lead content, and you got very sick. So because people ate tomatoes and got sick, they assumed tomatoes were poisonous. What was poisonous is the dishes they were using. So if you've got lead-containing dishes, you got to be very careful if you use them. Maybe you should just keep them around for decoration, and particularly things that have a high acid content, like a tomato, could be kind of dangerous. Lead is a very insidious material when it gets into the human body. I think it can affect IQ, and it can create various kinds of low-level diseases that are not easy to recognize. So be careful, in my opinion. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Roger. No, yeah, no doubt. In fact, there's a lot of belief that the fall of the Roman Empire was partially due to the amount of lead that people had in their bodies because of all the lead that was being used at the time in water supplies that they had, you know, advanced civilization to the point where they had running water in their house, in the most homes, of, especially the wealthy, or those in power. And they found, I guess, from exhumed bodies or whatever, that the lead content was extremely high. Even up to somewhat modern times, last century, or say 2 centuries ago, 19th century, that one of the expeditions, polar expeditions, early expeditions, they showed it on PBS, to find the Northwest Passage, that part of, they believe, part of the reason the expedition failed, that they had sufficient food, but the cannery, that was the first expedition that took cans, actually sealed up metal cans, which they thought would supply them enough food for years, were soldered together, and like you say, was just, boy, it looked like an insidious death that these bodies ate through what they went through from this, this high lead content in their body that go over.
206.
Picked up the wrong mic. Yeah, I saw that program, and a horrible program to describe the way they all died. Rich recognized. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I was listening subliminally, looking up on the internet or something, but what I'm wondering about, what is the possibility of someone like yourself or myself who has been working with solders? For instance, I've been soldering since I'm 7 years old and breathing the fumes from the solder. And I'll tell you what I did as a kid. A lot of kids 8, 9 years old don't know any better. I used to put solder in my mouth when I was about 8 years old and chew on it. Of course, by the time I turned 12 or 13, I knew better. But without getting into a whole medical discussion, some of the problems I've had in later years, I've never been tested for lead, but I don't even know that you test for it once you get something to the brain. I do have some problems which they say can be linked to lead. Whether those problems I have are is unknown.
Yeah, I don't know is the real bottom line here, Rich, but I'm worried also, like you. In my youth, I did an awful lot of soldering. I didn't actually put my nose right in the fumes coming off, but I was very nearby. And so when you're soldering, is there a significant lead fumes in that smoke that comes off? I think there could be. Chewing on lead, I know, is not good. There have been stories of children in metropolitan areas people would have paint peeling off the wall of their particular apartment, and they would chew the paint chips. And there is definitely a way of measuring the lead content of your body. There are specific tests that will measure parts per million and parts per billion of lead that's in your system. So you could find out whether or not you have an accumulation of lead. And yes, it does accumulate, particularly in the fat cells, I believe. So, and I know that there have been surveys done of children in metro areas where there was lead in the paint and they were chewing the chips, and it was definitely confirmed as to being a detriment to their education. So I know there are tests for it, and so with your resources, you could definitely request that test, in my opinion, Rich. And once you do or don't discover what lead content is in your body, I'm relatively sure there are actions that can be taken to purge some of that lead out of your body. I think there are techniques. N2EO, H-U-L-A-W on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I briefly discussed this with my internist, the lady doctor. I mentioned to her that I had heard about chelation therapy for lead. And I have different opinions. She didn't think much of it. But, no, I really should get tested for it, because not only did I chew on lead as a child, I've been soldering since I'm 6 or 7 years old, just about every day on the bench until a few years ago. And you talk about chewing on lead chips, I did that too, because back in the 50s, we lived in an apartment in Astoria on 28th Street by the foot of the Tricolor Bridge. I don't know if it was lead paint, but it's a good bet that it was.
WB2EAV.
Go right ahead, Ed.
A couple of hopefully cheering thoughts. First, I believe when the smoke coming from solder, like when you're doing electronic soldering, is the rosin flux, not the metals. I have no proof of that, but I've heard that, and I believe lead is literally a heavy metal, and I don't think the vapor goes wafting off into the air that easily. Secondly, this is totally fluky. Solder is a lead tin alloy. Now, I know mercury is a terrible poison, but a mercury silver alloy has been used for ages for fillings with no bad effects. Is it possible the lead tin alloy is less dangerous than pure lead? Dick?
I do know that there are modern instrumentation, Ed, where you can take a sample of the air that's in a person's mouth because they have amalgam filling and measure the amount of mercury vapor in that mouth because of those fillings. Now, is this parts per billion that you measure, is it significant when it comes to human health? We will argue that for many years to come. And there are people who are psychologically at least sensitive to this, and therefore there are people trying to have all of their amalgam fillings removed and replaced with composite fillings. So you can definitely measure the mercury vapor in a mouth with amalgam fillings. Therefore, I believe you could measure the mercury content in the solder fumes. I suspect it's very small. Like you said, the majority of it is the rosin, but the mercury is in a liquid form. The good news is the mercury itself is not boiling. Therefore, I think the amount of lead, the amount of lead in the fumes when you're doing soldering, because the solder is not boiling, I'd like to believe it's extremely small, and I think it's a high probability we're worrying about nothing on this one. But it could be measured. Back to you, Ed, for any further comments. It would be to EAV. It used to be an EAV, KQLIW.
Well, it was just some thoughts that I had on the subject. And remember, I believe we're all old enough now that it was really that bad, we'd be, if not dead, basket cases by now. So we are dealing with second order or third order effects just by virtue of the fact we lived this long, Dick.
Yeah, but Ed, in my youth, I used to be able to think faster, see better, run faster. And has it had any minor effects where now I'm a little more forgetful, don't think as fast, don't run as fast? And are any of the effects of my hobby a causative agent? We'll never know. And it's something to speculate about. And we're learning a lot as time goes on. But the solder that was used on those cans of that food for that expedition, Ed, you probably know, what was the name of that expedition? It wasn't the Shackleton. You happen to know the name of that expedition that we were talking about earlier?
Sorry, can't place that one. I know what you're talking about, but I can't place it. But let me say, there are 50 people on this frequency, Dick, who you may think you're not thinking as fast as you are, but there are 50 people on this frequency who think you're thinking plenty fast enough today.
Yeah, but those are the ones that I pay, Ed. I pay them periodically to sign in to say things like that. Thank you. Okay, let's turn back to Mel. And we didn't get a chance to get into the mailbag yet. K2KEY, K2RIW in the net. N2RQ, go right ahead.
Good evening, Dick. I want you to come in on that lead issue. Almost all the research has been focused on the effects of lead on young children, developing nervous systems, etc. All the standards that have been established concerning lead paint and exposure has been related to that, and it's been set up in terms of lead in public housing and schools. The effects are mostly in younger people. So, as Ed just said, if you've been around long enough, it may be there, but chances are the effect is not what you expect. But I do have an anecdote to relate if you want it.
I sure do. Mr. Malchick, fire away.
Probably about 90 years ago, my father worked in a factory in Brooklyn that manufactured storage batteries. And he was on the assembly line literally soldering the plates into place. And they set him on the line opposite the fastest guy on the line. And he melted down about as many as he succeeded in producing. He figured at the end of the first week they'd fire him. But they didn't. He quit anyway. He said you could never get the smell off from the factory. I don't think any of us have been exposed to anything like that. It's rather an interesting piece. As far as Ed's comment about the fumes, yes, it's mostly rosin, but I'm sure there is a certain amount of metallic outgas, even if it is small. Because I know I've dealt with mercury, and it's unbelievable what you can detect at small levels. I suspect that when you heat the lead, it's being entrained in that fume as well. Back to you, Dick.
Glad to hear all this, Lou. Lou, your father working in that storage battery facility, factory, how long was he there, and do you believe he did or did not have any side effects from that exposure?
He worked there 1 week. He was, I don't remember if he was still in high school, if he was in college, or if he was just out of college, somewhere around there. He couldn't stand it. The fumes were so bad that he said you could never, you'd go home and shower or whatever, you never got the smell off. And that drove him out, which I'm sure was probably good. We do metabolize the lead, even though it accumulates. We do excrete it just as we excrete mercury. But it accumulates because because the rate of excretion is so low.
The smell that your father couldn't get off of his body after working in that factory, do you believe it was the smell of the lead itself? And I think lead doesn't have any real smell. Or was it the solvents or the fluxes or things like this? Over to you, Lou.
I have no way of knowing. He used to refer to it as the lead. I don't know. But I think these metals definitely do have a smell. I've worked with them in the lab. And whether it's the metals themselves or the oxides or whatever, I'm sure you all have the experience. If you handle the metals and then smell your hands, usually you'll pick up a specific side odor. And it's hard to tell, but I've worked with sheet lead and with nickel and copper and zinc and silver, magnesium. They all seem to have a different odor.
Interesting subject, and I think more can be found out about it. And I share your concern, Rich, with all the soldering you've done. And I think the soldering is reasonably safe, but the chewing on the lead and the solder and chewing on paint chips, I'm a little worried. Let's see if Mel has heard anything along those lines. And Mel, maybe you want to go to the mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech map.
Okay, this is K2KEY. That expedition that we watched on PBS, that was the Franklin expedition, Dick. That failed expedition. Franklin was, of course, the captain of the ship, they took along, you know, tremendous amount of canned, as you saw, canned food, and they were all soldered to cancer. So the food that actually was supposed to save their lives actually, I guess, killed them off, as far as smelling solder. Well, of course, something also I've been doing since I was a kid. I never chewed on solder. I never had an appetite for solder or paint chips, thankfully. So I never got to that point. However, I will make one comment. I know of somebody, a friend. My brother had a lady friend years ago. Her mother was suffering with a peculiar condition. She had worked all her life out in Long Island City on an assembly line, soldering together, at that time working for a company made intercom, where, of course, they were all tube intercom, hand-soldered, you know, the entire, you know, piece of equipment together, and sitting on the assembly line there, with a number of other women sat at both sides of the table and just soldered away all day, put the components in. And they all, she said almost all of them suffered from some condition with their lungs, and with their breathing, basically, seem to all have that in common thing. So there may be a bottom line, whether it's the fumes or the solder, the lead in the solder, I really, you know, really can't say. But subsequently, I believe she passed away from some complications of that. Okay, let me let it drop.
WS to Antonio.
Okay, just got Paul aboard, so want to pick him up, Dick?
Yeah, I think we should. Now, Paul, you want to give us a space report for the US-2N? And before we go over to Paul, was there another person who just signed in?
Yes, Dick, KC2OES.
KC2OES. Let's find out. OES, you have a comment on the subject on the floor? If so, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Yes, Dick, this is Fred. I am a reloader. I also cast my own thinkers, and I've learned from reading and my experience with the lead. There's arsenic, antimony, cadmium, and the one trick that I've learned, I've actually had blood tests done to make sure that I was okay. To stay out of the smoke plume, that's the trick. Well, I flux, it turns into a flame, and that's safer because it was fast and high with the heat, you know, the air rises, but you don't want to stick your head in the boom, that's for sure.
Okay, Fred, now let's run this by one more time. I think you're saying that when you're doing reloading, particularly when you're making sinkers, are you saying that the lead in the sinkers contains a contaminant of arsenic, antimony, and cadmium? Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying some of the ingredients of the reloading contain those three other metals? Back to you, Fred.
Lead in itself carries different percentages. Lead has a signature or fingerprint, like, for example, they can tell what part of the world it came from, what mine, like with most metals, they can tell exactly what part of the world it came from. But they all have antimony, which makes lead harder for bullets. Different speeds, higher, you know, velocities require harder bullets. So you add tin, antimony, and there is a small percentage of arsenic in lead. It occurs naturally in nature.
Okay, so I think you're saying when you were tested, not only did they test it for lead in your body, but they tested for these other substances, arsenic, tin, antimony, and cadmium. Is that what you're saying, Fred?
That's correct. If you're reasonably careful not to keep your head in the plume, to keep your head clear, it's outdoors especially. Indoors, it's a different environment. No matter what you do indoors, it's going to accumulate in your clothing. It's absorbed through the skin. It's absorbed, you know, by breathing, and it gets in the blood. And yes, the rate of dissemination through your body is a lot slower than the absorption.
So if I understand you correctly, then just putting an amount of lead in a crucible of some kind to bring it to the liquid form so that you can pour it into the mold to make sinkers, just that process itself, I think you're saying put some of these substances in the air. Is that true, Fred?
Yes, and not only that, you're using different fluxes, which can be anything from paraffin, beeswax, which is the paraffin is petroleum. Motor oils also are used for flux and commercial fluxes. Now, the commercial fluxes have even more chemicals in them yet, which I can't even go into the list.
Now, these fluxes, is this in order to be a demolding substance, in other words, so that the sinker can easily be removed from the mold? Is that why you're using flux in that environment?
No, negative. It's not a mold release. It's different types of petroleum products that usually it's a petroleum product, the beeswax or motor oil, to make the different metals that are in lead or chemicals that are in lead mixed so that you get like batches. In other words, if you cast 1,000 bullets, you want everyone to weigh, say, 58 grains or 158 grains. That's how you keep your lot or your batch equal by fluxing.
How about that? So, I think you're saying that the flux acts as catalyst, to create a more uniform mixture of those other metals, which gives you a more uniform weight of each of your shells. Is that the idea?
That's correct, yes. And the harder you make your batch, the more they shrink. The more pure lead that's in there, they don't shrink as much, but they're also heavier than the batch that you mix to make harder. When they cool, if you cool them fast, they shrink quicker. They have a tendency to crack. If you don't have the right mix and you cool them too fast, they crack. But all those things are in lead, naturally occur in nature.
Interesting subject. Another example where if you think it's simple, you don't understand the problem. Looks like we've got to all dig more into this one. I wrote a report with reference to radio frequency biohazard about 3 years ago. You can go to the Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG, and they have on their second page of their technical articles something they call the K2RIW Corner, where you'll find an assembly of 6 or 7 of the articles that I've written over the years that they've put all in one place. When I say article, I mean articles I've published on the Microwave Reflector, a listserv group. and one of those is a biohazard set of articles. And I was speculating that if someone could prove, or try to prove, that our IQ had been lowered by 1 point or 3 points because of the various exposures we had because of our particular hobby, ham radio. Let me drop. Whether it would be radio exposures, I did specifically say the fumes from soldering and the risk from climbing towers and whatever. I put a bunch of things together and I said, if someone could confirm that it lowered your IQ by 1, 2, or 3 points over a lifetime of that particular hobby, would you and I still have the hobby? And the conclusion I came to is probably yes. If you love the hobby enough, you would find ways of rationalizing what we do. You'd find ways of minimizing the risk, but you'd go right on doing it. There's a degree of risk in everything we do. Certainly driving an automobile, where 40,000 Americans die per year in automobiles. Driving an automobile is a risky thing to do. But the risk-to-benefit ratio is so high in our favor that, of course, we're going to do it. Very few of us are going to walk to work every day, ride a bicycle to work every day. We don't. Our place of occupation is usually not close enough to do that. And so there are many things that we do that involve risk. Another example I gave is that many communities will say, you're not going to put a nuclear power station in my community. It's too risky. You're not going to do that in my backyard. But those same people complaining about that might drive their children to school with their automobile and not insist that the child wear a seatbelt. And the seatbelt risk could be 10,000 times greater than the risk you would have over a lifetime of having a nuclear power station in your county. So risk is something that's highly misunderstood. There's been a number of articles in the AAAS on that exact subject, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and their particular journal called Science Magazine. Quite often they've gotten into the subject of risk assessment, and most of us have a pretty poor understanding of what real risk is and what we can do to mitigate it. Again, we're off the subject, whatever that particular subject happened to be. Mel, want to try again? K2KEY, K2RIW, you're going to the mailbag, I think.
Pick up Paul. Let's get some information on what's going on in the mobile head. Seeing that we're all sort of, high on this smoke from soccer. Let's listen to what Paul has to say about space, to begin with, because I know he has to get out of here earlier.
You're absolutely right. And it's all those fumes I've smelled all these years that made me forget that Paul's waiting. Paul, you got it.
Okay, Dick, I did want to make a comment about the paint fumes, in lead. There is some terrific amount of lead that is in that old paint. We had to cut through steel stairwells in a very old building called the Yale Club in Manhattan to install a 4-inch inside diameter steel pipe for a sandpipe for fire prevention. We had to run it the whole 24 length through the very 1930-odd building coated with lead paint, and to cut through the steel, we use an oxyacetylene torch, and we're making a 5-inch hole through every single floor. But we tried the first floor, and the amount of smoke that comes off of the paint, gold paint, coated with lead, mixed with lead, is unbelievable. When you cut with an oxyacetylene torch, depending on the materials you're running, cutting through, the color of the flame actually changes. You could see this almost like yellowish color coming off. I've cut through plenty of steel with regular paint, modern day paint, and you don't get this effect. You sure do with the lead. And after doing hole number one up on top, we brought in fans, vented it through the ceiling, and went from there on, and progressively all the way down, and installed the standpipe for fire prevention. but a terrific amount of lead there. Both a different color. You notice some bad news. I just want to make that comment before Space Report.
Well, you brought up a very good point. A torch produces a flame of many thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. It vaporizes almost everything that's in that plasma. And so now, no matter what the material is, lead, tin, solder, antimony, cadmium, arsenic, all of those materials will definitely be vaporized in a torch. A friend of mine built himself a great big phased array antenna on 432 megacycles using galvanized steel tubing, I think it was EMT tubing, and galvanized steel rods. And he was doing this by arc welding in a garage. He got sick to the degree that was life-threatening because of all the fumes of the zinc that was being vaporized in that process of him building the welded structure of galvanized materials. So soldering is nowhere near as bad. It doesn't have anywhere near as high a temperature. But any kind of a weld torch has temperatures that can vaporize anything. And so to do that in an indoor environment that's not extremely well ventilated, I think can create a tremendous amount of problems. Back to you, Paul. KQRIW, EtherTechNet. Wait for the beep.
Okay, I concur. Yeah, and with galvanized, if you take any kind of galvanized steel and you start with the torch, you're going to get greenish glow from that torch as you're cutting more green than normal. You can tell right away. And zinc. Oh, my father got the that zinc poisoning years ago. He was a welder in the shipyard. Back in those days, their cure was drinking milk. I always thought lead had a similar base, but you know, similar of an effect to the body as zinc did. I'm a believer in drinking plenty of milk, but I've yet to read anything about it. But I think that tends to counteract the effect of lead. I know it does with the zinc, and work in the shipyards. Back in those days, in the 30s, they weren't big on ventilation or whatever. I mean, you got involved with galvanized welding or using cutting torches, and these people, quite a few of them, got that particular type of sickness you're talking about that's caused from the zinc from the galvanized metal.
KB1LQN Mobile.
KB1LQN. I thought of your name and your question or comment, sir.
His name is Steve. I'm in a mobile over here in Syosset. My question is, you're talking about the welding and the smoke and the plumes and stuff. I've got a cousin who is an underwater welder, cutter, and such. The smoke plume, would it have the same effect underwater?
So, Steve, are you telling us or asking us? I'm not quite sure what you said. Back to you, Steve. My name is Dick.
And we've spoken before. I'm asking, how would that effect of the, they talk about the smoke plume, and obviously not put your head in it, but the mixed with the oxygen and underwater and all that stuff, would there be any kind of effect there?
Okay, your relative, by definition, was using a self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. He was not breathing the fumes in that water. Probably he was wearing the equivalent of a wetsuit if he's doing it for any length of time. So therefore, even the plume itself, the bubbles coming up in the water, were not directly touching his skin. I think his exposure was small because of his scuba gear. But I'm no expert on this. You're hearing an opinion. He had to be wearing the scuba gear. Is that true, Steve? Go ahead.
Yes, yeah, he would be wearing full scuba gear, tanks, the mask and everything, helmet. Yeah, I guess I kind of answered my own question, right?
Yeah, very similar to the Scott pack that the firemen carry when they go into a burning building. They're breathing their air that they brought in their tanks, as opposed to whatever's contained in the building. The stuff contained in the building could get them in a heap of trouble in a hurry. The thing to worry about, though, is that the Scott packs, I think, at best only last 20 minutes. You got to really keep track of how long you've been in the building, when it's about to run out. You may have to walk back down the line, the hose that you use to go in with, in order to find your way out. And I've talked to a couple of firemen who have described horror stories of getting out of a building in a hurry when their Scott pack ran out. And really scary stuff. Okay. Boy, what pleasant subjects we're into today, Paul. Paul, give us a thumbnail sketch as to what's going on in space. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this week, well, there's not really that that much new this week. I know the 11th, we have the launch of Endeavour to the International Space Station, bringing the COBE lab up, as well as the Dextrous robotic arms, plural. You know, I gave out the website last week. That's an incredible-looking gadget. I'm surprised it hasn't made the news. I'd like to see more details about this. To be able to feel the pulse and the things that you touch and, on the outside of the space station, inside the space station, as you're operating the thing, it sounds very complicated. Our piece of equipment that's going to be doing this work to remove batteries, taking them apart, covers and taking broken amplifiers, relocating cables, doing things that spacewalkers normally do. I really have to look more into this. I haven't seen much about it, though. It looks like quite a piece of equipment. Each arm, meaning half a dozen or more joints. You know, we have an elbow joint, shoulder joint and wrist joint. This thing's got about seven joints along each arm. Two arms, body itself swings around. It's really quite a piece of equipment. The main point of the mission, of course, is to bring the COBE lab up, another big room for the International Space Station. But I'd like to see more of this thing built by built in Canada. And that should be pretty good. You know, years ago, they talked about saving the Hubble, sending a robotic piece of equipment up. I knew they weren't ready then, and this will be the first type of piece of equipment that could really do the type of work or anything close to it. I still think that they're probably years away from developing that when we drop it. And eventually, they'll probably come along to the point maybe it could be done in the future. Hopefully this thing works out and they'll continue to develop a system like this, because my hopes are after Atlantis, which just came back from the Columbus deployment of the Columbus module to the space station, another lab that is now set up and operating. Atlantis is being refitted and getting ready for the last, in my opinion, human service mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. Maybe in the future, if this piece of equipment works out on the space station, maybe they could develop this further, where 2010 you're going to have the end of the space shuttle flight. They're retiring them. That's why you see so many flights going right after the other, one after the other now. You're going to have a 3 or 4 year lag after that, so call, let's say 2013, 2014. Hopefully the Hubble Space Station will be able to last maybe, maybe 5, 10 years out. And maybe we'll be serviced future by one of these robotic pieces of equipment. It doesn't sound feasible now. This thing is going to be good, but not good enough to do a Hubble service mission. But good enough for the space station to do the work that they plan.